I'm Amy Halverson, and I am pleased to introduce the 2018 Ravin Lecturer, Dr. John Fung. Dr. Fung is really a pioneer in transplant surgery. He went to medical school at the University of Chicago and then did his training at Rochester and then did a fellowship in transplant surgery at the University of Pittsburgh, where he trained under Tom Starzl. He spent many years at Pittsburgh, then he was at the Cleveland Clinic, and he has most recently returned to University of Chicago to head up the transplant program there. In addition to being an incredibly skilled surgeon, he is a brilliant scientist. He has his PhD in immunology from the University of Chicago. He's published more than 1,000 articles and book chapters. And he really is one of the giants in transplant surgery. It's an honor to have him here today. Thank you, Dr. Fung.
Well, thank you, Amy. I really appreciate the honor of being here. I'm not sure about the crowd, but anyway, I hope that those that you are here that will take away a few learning points. It's interesting that this is the 104th Congress of the American College of Surgeons, and this is a 52nd Ravin Lecture, which means that I have the privilege to be at the midpoint of the importance of recognition of the American College of Surgeons relating to the basic and surgical sciences. I have no relevant financial relationships or conflicts of interest that relate to this presentation. So I thought, as I prepare for this, to do a little bit of background work about the person for whom this lecture is named after. And there are obviously Ravin was well-known to the organization. He has the biography. He was born in Evansville, Indiana, which you'll see later on has tie-in with myself, Indiana University undergraduate, and then moved to University of Pennsylvania and spent the rest of his career there, during which time he rose to be the Harrison Professor of Surgery and Surgeon-in-Chief of the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. He was also held the position as a Barton Professor of Surgery. And during World War II, was the commanding officer of the Assam, India, 20th General Hospital, which in itself is an interesting story. Many kudos that went to that unit. He achieved the position as a major general in the U.S. Army. This picture of him in India. At an academic level, American College of Surgeons president, American Cancer Society president, and president of the American Surgical Association, and he passed away in 1972. He had 137 citations, at least that I could identify, in PubMed. Much of this related to his position as director of the Harrison Department of Surgical Research. Looking at the past 51 lectures before this, and I won't go through each one, but you'll see there are some very notable speakers in the past 51 years, including some of my mentors, people that I've trained under, including Tom Starzl, Rich Simmons, as well as other notable scientists here. And trying to assimilate all that and condense it into sort of what are the topics of the Ravin lectures include physiology, metabolism, genetics, cancer, some transplantation, regenerative medicine, nutrition, critical care, and infections. And so my talk is suppressing the immune system, the good, bad, and the ugly. And you see the three pictures, and as I go through my talk, I will explain each one of those to you. So transplant immunology really is not that old of a field. Peter Medawar in the British Army Medicine at the time identified an interesting phenomenon where allogenic skin was being used as temporary dressings for burns suffered during the Battle of Britain in 1940. From that, he made some observations. This is a picture of a young woman, actually, with deep third-degree burns. You can see the granulation tissue. At the bottom of the wounds are skin-punched grafts taken from herself, from another side of her body, and the ones up in her shoulder are taken from her brother. A few weeks later, you can see that the skin grafts from at the bottom part of her wound have coalesced, formed a nice epithelialized surface, whereas the skin punches taken from her brother put in the shoulder have gotten smaller, and biopsies of those show typical what we would consider now as rejection, small lymphoid, mononuclear lymphoid-type cells within the skin. And he published this as an article called The Fate of Skin Homografts in Man. A few years later, it was actually identified that the major histocompatibility complex, or also known as the human leukocyte antigen complex, identified on chromosome 6, was the protein genetic loci that was associated with the foreignness of tissue, and for this Nobel Prize was awarded to Jean Dassay and George Snell. And so all of the transplants that had been done prior to the 1954 success had failed because of rejection. And the barrier of rejection was surmounted by the identification of a donor-recipient pair that happened to be identical twins. This was done by Joe Murray and his team at the Brigham. And this ushered in the concept of being able to replace organs for organ failure with the caveat that the immune system would have to be overcome. In the bone marrow field, Donald Thomas also was able to get transplant of bone marrow for leukemia, and again required the use of living donor twins in order to be able to eliminate the immune system of the recipient as well as a tumor in leukemia and reconstitute that with identical twin bone marrow. The 1990 Nobel Prize was awarded to both of them for this work, and you see the similarity is that it did require the use of identical twins. And so in 1959, transplantation was required essentially that you had to have HLA matching, you had to be identical twins. Once you got it, you were tolerant, you didn't need immunosuppression. The problem is not too many of us that require transplant have an identical twin, so the lack of applicability was the biggest problem with transplantation at that time. The development of nonspecific immunosuppression was ushered in by Gertrude Ellion and George Hitchings, working for Burroughs Wellcome, described the compound 6-mercaptopurine and its prodrug, azathioprine, and with this, the beginning of nonspecific immunosuppression or chemical immunosuppression started. In 1961 and going up to 1963, Starzl and a number of other centers around the world used a combination of azathioprine and prednisone in order to gain successful non-identical twin allotransplantation, the largest series being done at the University of Colorado. And it should be of interest that almost 50 years later, more than 50 years later, some of these patients, 8 of the original 64 in that series, still had functioning kidneys, and some of these patients had been immunosuppression free, no azathioprine, no prednisone, for up to 44 years. So the picture that's good, this is Robert Phillips at Starzl's 90th birthday, who had been a 52-year recipient of a kidney transplant and had been immunosuppression free for more than 20 of those. So with this nonspecific immunosuppression, the mirror image of bone marrow and solid organ sort of began to take different routes. In other words, we didn't need to have identical twin matching in order to get successful organ transplantation. The risk of solid organ versus bone marrow was the development of host versus graft disease or rejection. In contrast to bone marrow transplantation, where tissue typing matching was important, but the Achilles heel of that procedure was graft versus host disease. So with these two limitations, the focus on minimizing graft loss from rejection or graft versus host disease focused on the development of new immunosuppressive agents. And so small molecules are represented at the bottom biologic agents represented on the top of the timeline. And you can see that it's been increasing development over the past 20, 30 years in the development of new immunosuppressive drugs. And this has led to an incremental decrease in rejection rates over time, very common now with different organ systems to see rejection rates in the low double digits. So what has this done? Well, this is a graph showing patient survival with liver transplants under the azathioprine era of 35% 1 year survival, going up to 70% under cyclosporine, and then 85% with the development of FK506, now known as tacrolimus. And this is, are the three pivotal studies that led to worldwide adoption of tacrolimus, not just for liver transplant, but in fact for all solid organ and early bone marrow transplant. The problem with these immunosuppressive agents are the side effects. And you can see that after 8 years of transplant, the leading cause of death in the transplant, liver transplant population, as with many other organ systems, are malignancy and renal failure. And so in the pyramid of what we consider important in transplantation over the past 30 years, you can see we've been able to overcome gradually patient graft survival, reduce the incidence of rejection, moving up the scale, getting to the top of the pyramid, which will be achieving value of transplant. And how do you achieve value? It's longevity of graft, decreased cost, and particularly immunosuppression costs if we can eliminate the use of immunosuppression, and minimize all of the complications of immunosuppressive drugs, including renal disease and de novo malignancy. So how could this be done? This is a focus, what we call the holy grail in transplantation, achieving tolerance, which is defined as acceptance of the transplanted graft without the need for immunosuppression and without having any functional impairment. Hard to measure, we call operational tolerance, defined as stability of graft function without the use of immunosuppression. At this Rabdin lecture in 2004, Dr. Starzl presented a concept of how tolerance may be achieved. His hypothesis was that the donor organ transplanted would have cells from donor origin emigrate out of the graft, interact with the recipient immune system, leading to some kind of dissolution of the responses in the recipient to the transplanted graft. And at that time, we had some indication that this required an active process of apoptosis, but it would be left to further science to understand exactly how this interaction would occur. So with that, I'm going to give you a brief primer on transplant immunology. This is a textbook that I contributed to a few years ago, Immunology for Surgeons. For those in your room that might be interested, there might be something here that you can pick up. But I will just simplify the idea moving to what I want to focus on. So innate adaptive immunity, you remember that from medical school. There are a number of different factors. I think one thing that we begin to appreciate is that the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system actually collaborate and communicate in ways that we had never appreciated before. And I'll infer that at my very end of my presentation. But on the left, on the right-hand column, you'll see, or figure, the circle around the helper T cell. So as it relates to transplant rejection, because these are protein-related antigens, the helper T cell, or CD4 T cell, is a critical in the hub of activation of the immune system. So most of the drugs that we have focused in studies have focused on the helper T cell, because we feel that if we can control the CD4 helper T cell, that we can minimize or control the rejection rates. I think all of us remember, maybe in medical school, that the T cell interacts with an antigen-presenting cell. This generates some signals that allows the T cells then to secrete a T cell growth factor known as interleukin-2, and this leads to proliferation of those T cells. The T cells do their business as an effector cell, and then somehow they die off. through this activation and do cell death, and you're left with memory T cells that can come back with a vengeance when it sees the antigen again. So I think this is what we were taught in medical school. Over time, there have been further studies that have elucidated T cell function, including the identification and the evolution of T cell receptors, as well as the role of T cell co-receptors, CD4 and CD8. So this is an important cartoon that will address what I will be focusing on in terms of this talk. And this is how T cells and antigen-presenting cells talk to each other. So we know the T cell receptor requires interaction with the HLA component, in this case an MHC class 2, with an antigen that recognizes the T cell receptor, binds to it, and then stabilizes through the CD4. And this is what we call signal 1. But we also realize now that without the signal 2, which is the set of proteins on the left, interaction between CD8 on the T cell and B7 on the antigen-presenting cell, the co-stimulation, without this, the T cell becomes inertic, cannot respond. So to get optimal T cell activation, you need both signal 1 and signal 2. This leads to T cell activation. Now, 10 years later, these two scientists, Tsuko Hanjo and James Allison at Mayo, identified a set of regulatory inhibitory co-stimulation signals, what we now call as immune checkpoints. And if you've been reading the media, they just received the Nobel Prize for this work last month. These are critical observations in how T cells become regulated. So we've talked about activation. What they appreciated was that once the T cell becomes activated, it sets off a set of transcription in that activated T cell that upregulates a new protein called CTLA-4. Interestingly, it has some similar structural characteristics to CD28, but CTLA-4 binds to B7 in a much higher affinity, and when it does so, the T cell becomes inactivated. And this leads to T cell inhibition. Since then, a number of additional protein and ligands have been identified in the T cell activation site, including CD40, CD40 ligand, as a number of other co-stimulatory positive signals, as well as inhibitory signals. And what we'll be focusing on, besides the CTLA-4, B7 complex interaction, is another very potent interaction, PD for programmed death 1 and its ligand programmed death ligand 1. There are other inhibitory signals in this pathway of T cell suppression. One that's very exciting, which is still being coming out with new papers on a weekly basis, is the VISTA protein that's involved in T cell suppression. Its ligand has not yet been identified. So with that, go back to tolerance. What about tolerance? Well, in 1960, the Nobel Prize was awarded to Burnett and Medawar for their work on immunologic tolerance. They showed that an immature immune system, as seen in neonatal mice, could be rendered tolerant by giving them antigen exposure during the evolution of their immune system. The problem is that that's great to do in neonates because their immune system is very plastic. In adults that are already immunocompetent, in order to achieve this type of neonatal tolerance, induction strategies which require significant cytoablation, radiation, chemical, biological cytoablation, to render the recipient immuno-incompetent, then allowing the transplanted organ to grow up in a maturing immune system, is very difficult to do and fraught with a number of complications. I think some of the key about tolerance then comes from what we have already known and observed in our transplant practice, that some allografts, some transplanted organs, are very prone to develop, or much more prone to develop, operational tolerance than others. In particular, livers are not uncommonly associated with the ability to be weaned off immunosuppression, more so than kidneys, more so than hearts, lungs, and intestine. And the caveat to that is the reverse order of that is associated with the risk of rejection, and particularly chronic rejection. And so the bad is what you see here, intestinal allograft vasculopathy. In fact, this is a very similar pattern in all organs that undergo chronic rejection, which is this arterial hyperproliferation of the intima, probably cytokine-driven, that leads to eventual graft loss because of ischemia. This is an artery. It's seen in coronary arteries and kidneys and in livers and other organs that undergo rejection. So what is the ability to withdraw immunosuppression? Well, we in Pittsburgh at the time, as well as other centers over time, have shown that about 20% of adults who have liver transplant can be successfully withdrawn from immunosuppression. Children have a slightly higher rate, between 40 and 60% of these patients can be withdrawn from their immunosuppression without penalty. Why the liver? Why more so than the other organs? Well, one hypothesis is that the liver is an immune system with an innate ability to regulate its own immune system. It is exposed to gut-associated peptides, proteins, as well as endotoxin, which is a very stimulant molecule to macrophages, as well as other associated inflammation. Other types of diseases like viral hepatitis B and C, once it reaches chronicity, the liver is then sort of faced with the decision of trying to eliminate it and killing itself versus allowing the virus to live while it still allows the recipient or the host to survive. And we also know that the liver turns out to be a fairly popular place for metastatic diseases to go to. A unique recognition of the liver as an immunomodulatory organ has been recognized by many people, and I think this title is a good one, the liver as a site of T-cell apoptosis, graveyard or killing field, and you'll see that in the next few slides. So the liver is very interesting because it was observed almost 50 years ago by Roy Kahn and in the lab with rats, that the liver allografts in pigs and rats could be occasionally transplanted without the use of immunosuppression and then lead to stability and hyporesponsive or tolerance to other donor tissues. We have seen from clinical observations that the liver can neutralize HLA antibodies, protect itself from hyperacute rejection. There's a lower incidence of chronic rejection. And as you'll see, in mice, we don't need immunosuppression, and we could then use this model as a way to study the mechanisms of tolerance. What you see here is a very potent effect of the transplanting a hamster liver into a rat, which is protected from rejection, then protecting secondary hamster skin from rejection versus a mouse skin in the C3H. So the potency of tolerance associated with liver transplant is quite robust. In 1989, we embarked on a model to be able to use the mouse as a liver transplant model. Realizing that most mice are about 25 to 30 grams when we operate on them, taking out the liver or transplanting that is quite a technical feat. We did develop an orthotopic non-arterialized model that allowed us to study the immunologic effect of transplantation. So using this model, we happen to use in this cartoon B6 black C357 black 6 mice, which are H2B, into a C3H mouse, which is H2K, fully dyspareic MHC combination. And what we observed without the use of immunosuppression was on serial biopsies at day 7, a very brisk cellular infiltrate that is indistinguishable from acute rejection that we would see in the clinics. Interestingly, a few weeks later, if we biopsy those animals, you see that the infiltrate's gone, the liver looks pristine. In addition, as we identified before, the liver induces systemic tolerance. And so if I transplant a heart from B10 mouse into C3H, it will be rejected. So at 10 to 12 days. If we transplant a liver, as I said, it's indefinitely survives. If we take a heart and a liver from the same strain mouse, both organs will survive for more than 100 days. If we take a heart from a congenic B10D2, which is H2D, the same as the B10H2B, then you see that the heart will be rejected at 12 to 13 days, although the liver will continue to survive. So we were interested in looking at what are the cells that are in the liver during this period of evolution from rejection to tolerance. And so what we recognize is taking the cells out from these livers is that, and testing them in cytotoxicity, that we could identify very brisk cytotoxicity of these infiltrating cells. At day 4, it's in the red curve here. Day 7, day 14. But by 110 days after transplant, if we took those livers out, extracted cells, there was no cytotoxicity. Interestingly, if we take out the spleen from those animals at the same time, you can see, again, at day 4, 7, and 14, there are certainly a lot of cytotoxic CD8 cells that we can identify in the spleens. But interestingly, at 110 days, they still exist. So it means that the clonal deletion, tolerance is not related to clonal deletion. In other words, these, if that were true, then we would not have been able to detect these cells in the spleen. So the paradox is we get the livers to be accepted spontaneously with evolution that looks like rejection to tolerance. The cells are not in the liver, but they are within the immune system of the recipient, and somehow those cells are held at bay. We know that we can tilt the system to rejection by adding pro-inflammatory cytokines, IL-2 and IL-12, at the time of transplant, or simply by presensitizing the donor of the recipient by giving a donor skin graft before, in other words, ramping up the immune system of the recipient. There are other observations, and this observation that fast ligand knockout, which, as you know, fast ligand is a set of proteins within the mitochondria that are responsible for mitochondrial function and when it's involved in the process of apoptosis. And when you have a knockout animal that can't kill T cells or can't undergo fast ligand-mediated apoptosis, those recipients will reject. So this is an isotype C3H to C3H at day 7, no inflammation in the liver, B10 to C3H transplant. You can see here the at day 4, these brown spots are tunnel stain or apoptotic bodies within the liver, and by day 7, when you see this large cellular infiltrate where it looks indistinguishable from rejection, you see a lot of these apoptotic bodies within the liver. So when we look at these over time, you see a lot of apoptotic bodies within that graft, and they begin to fall. These are cells from animals taken that were given IL-2, so in other words, they were induced to reject. And you can see there really is no apoptosis because IL-2 rescues T cells from apoptosis. When we look at CD4 versus CD8, most of the cells that are dying through apoptosis are in the CD8 cytotoxic fraction of the cellular infiltrate. So over time, what we see at stability at 40 days is that the CD8 population falls, and CD4 population stays relatively same or slightly higher. And when we stain these CD4 cells for markers of CD25 and FOXP3, which are regulatory T cell phenotype, you can see that most of these cells that are here are represented, many of them are represented by T regulatory phenotypes. So the takeaway point here being that in these grafts over time, the evolution of tolerance requires that the CD8 T cells undergo apoptosis or cell death, whereas the CD4 switch their phenotype from a pro-inflammatory Th1 phenotype to more of a T regulatory phenotype. What are T regs? Well, again, going back a little bit into the textbook, T regulatory cells suppress T cell function. They do that in one of two mechanisms. One, by a protein, the CTLA-4, which I told you binds to CD28 and then suppresses T-cell activation or inhibition. And then also through a secondary pathway which utilizes IDO, which is an enzyme associated with tryptophan metabolism. The starvation of tryptophan and other amino acids also downregulates T-cell function. So we now are at a point where we're trying to figure out what are the mechanisms of tolerance. And interestingly, I mentioned that the full liver is accepted. If we just take the liver cells, the hepatocytes out, and transplant them, they're rejected. Same tempo as if we put in a heart or a piece of skin. So it suggests to us that the tolerant component of the liver actually resides outside of the parenchymal cell, outside of the hepatocytes. And so if you digest the liver down, you'll see that only about 60% of the cells in the liver are hepatocytes. And the non-parenchymal cell population are composed of many other different types of cells. And I'll get to the chase. We're very interested in hepatic stellate cells, and I'll tell you why. Because the hepatic stellate cells are unique. They are mesenchymal in origin. Interesting, as you know, vitamin A, the liver is the primary reservoir for vitamin A and other retinoids in the body. In fact, it accounts for 80% of the retinoids in your body. They also are involved in a number of other things, are responsible for fibrosis and wound healing. They lay down extracellular matrix as part of the fibrosis to cirrhosis transition in liver injury. They also secrete a number of cytokines that are relatively common within the mesenchymal cell population, which are TGF-beta, IL-2, and vascular endothelial cell growth factor. So why are these important? Well, going back to immunology, if the dendritic cell or antigen-presenting cell interacts with the CD4 T cell, it has a pro-inflammatory cytokine, IL-12, that drives the T cell differentiation to pro-inflammation, T helper 2, which secretes the gamma interferon, tumor necrosis factor alpha. In the setting of the liver, where the mesenchymal stem or mesenchymal cell type hepatic stellate cell synthesizes TGF-beta, in the presence of retinoic acid, what happens is that these cells, naive CD4 cells, actually get driven to a immunosuppressive T cell state, T regulatory cells that make more TGF-beta and IL-10. So going back to this model of liver transplant, what we see in this cellular population, when we stain for hepatic stellate cells, they have a protein called glial fibrillar acid protein. When you stain for them, we can actually look at the dendritic cells and enumerate them, and there are increased number of hepatic stellate cells in the portal areas of livers that have acute inflammation. If you isolate these hepatic stellate cells, you can purify them. This is what they look like. You can see on bifringence microscopy, these bodies are retinoids. And when you activate them, they become fibroblastic. They upregulate smooth actin, muscle actin, and desmin, as shown on these two panels here. They also upregulate a very interesting protein family regulatory protein, which we talked about before, PDL1, programmed death ligand 1. And you can see here, at the quiescent stage, and then when they are given interferon, they upregulate this protein. And if I remind you that PDL1 interacts with PD1 to suppress T cell function. PDL1 expression in these cells, hepatic stellate cells, is not only dose dependent. You can see here, as more interferon is given, you can see the amount of PDL1 expression on hepatic stellate cells go up. But over time, the same occurs. So at 0 hours to 48 hours, the expression of PDL1 on these hepatic stellate cells also increases. Interferon gamma is a critical cytokine in the activation of hepatic stellate cells. And remember, interferon gamma is secreted by the first wave of T cell activation, the T helper 1 activation, encountering the antigen these cells start to make gamma interferon, which then secondarily stimulate the hepatic stellate cell. If you take a mouse who has no interferon gamma receptor, in other words, you can add all the interferon gamma you want, but they aren't responding because they don't have the receptor, you can see that unlike the wild-type animals that survive indefinitely, these animals will reject very quickly because they are unable to induce this regulatory pathway. And in fact, if you look at these cells under with immunohistochemical staining, these rejecting grafts are full of CD8-positive cells in green here, compared to the wild-type where the CD8 cells are quickly fading away. So the takeaway point here being hepatic stellate cells require interferon gamma to become activated, and that induces this regulatory pathway. T-cell apoptosis in these liver allografts are PD-1 dependent, and if we also take away this interaction between PD-1, PD-L1 to suppress T-cell activation, by using a PD-L1 knockout mouse, you can see these animals will reject by day 6. And if we look at the infiltrating cells within the liver allografts that are rejecting, there is no apoptosis, in contrast to the wild type, where you can see a lot of ongoing T-cell death. Also, this can PD-L1 monoclonal antibody, which will neutralize or bind to the PD-L1, will inhibit the activation-induced cell death of T-cells. So we can block this tolerance or apoptosis mechanism of T-cell death by using an antibody to PD-L1. And you'll see this begins to give you some idea of perhaps where this talk will be going in terms of cancer therapy. So how potent is hepatic stellate cells in protecting other organs? We tested this in an islet transplant model using, again, B6, in this case, BALB-C islets co-incubated with hepatic stellate cells, and then put it into streptozotocin-induced diabetic mice under the renal capsule. If we do that, islets alone, you can see they're rejected very quickly. If we add hepatic stellate cells, we get prolonged graft function. If we do a nephrectomy, the blood sugars will go up, verifying that the kidney that's transplanted with the islets, in fact, is what's keeping the euglycemic state. These are what the islets look like under the kidney capsule. Hepatic stellate cells also are very potent synthesizers of vascular endothelial growth factor. You can see the neovascularization of the islets under the capsule. Islets unprotected by hepatic stellate cell co-administration are rejected. You can see a very brisk cellular infiltrate. The red are staining for insulin. And in the co-incubated, administered hepatic stellate cells with islets at 126 days, very well-formed islets protected by what turns out to be a sheath of hepatic stellate cells within this stroma around the hepatic cell around the islets, and this is also like the liver. This protection is mediated through reduction of CD8 cells. And so, islets alone, you can see within the infiltrate, 23% of these cells are CD8 positive, and in the population of islets taken from long-term survivors, you can see that only 8% of them are CD8 positive. The inhibition of hepatic stellate cells also affects proliferation, so that the incubation of hepatic stellate cells with CD8 suppresses the proliferation as measured by the uptake of CFSE, a marker for DNA proliferation. So the hepatic stellate cells suppress T cell proliferation, and if you use a PD-L1, a knockout hepatic stellate cell, it's unable to prevent T cell proliferation. The cell infiltrates long-term are also positive for T regulatory phenotype. You can see that in long-term surviving islets where hepatic stellate cells are incubated, the percentage of T cell or the number of T regulatory cells in those grafts are markedly upregulated. And this is also true in the draining lymph nodes here, shown here. This is the kidney with the islets. The draining lymph nodes here in mice are also upregulated, the T regulatory cells, meaning that this is more of a systemic phenomenon and may account for the impact of how a tolerance is induced at a systemic level. So just to focus on this and move away from the base, this into the more clinical realm, is to summarize what I've shown you is the interaction of alloantigen donor dendritic cells with naive T cells leads to interferon gamma activation through the T helper 1 normal T cell activation. In the presence of mesenchymal stem cells, and particularly hepatic stellate cells, the quiescent hepatic stellate cells become activated. They secrete a number of substances, including retinoic acid, also involve other cofactors such as TGF-beta and IL-10. These activated hepatic stellate cells induce PD-L1, which is able to suppress further T cell activation, also dramatically changes the pathway of T cells into a T regulatory phenotype. And what I won't be getting into, which is also very exciting, is that the development of myeloid-derived suppressor cells, or MDSCs, is also enhanced through this mechanism. There is also the connection between the innate and adaptive immune response in that this pathway is also upregulated through the presence of a complement degradation product called inactive C3b. It is a byproduct of C3 activation, where C3a and C3b are cleaved from C3 during an inflammatory process. C3b is inactivated, and this IC3b molecule is very potent in the generation of myeloid-derived suppressor cells. So here's the ugly. This is a liver where transplanted with a donor-transmitted melanoma. You can see all of these are melanoma, nests of melanoma cells that have grown. And this patient eventually died, as you would expect, because not only was the liver not rejected, but the transmitted metastatic melanoma could also not be treated because the patient was tolerant to both the liver and to the melanoma. So there are many similarities between cancer and tolerance in that tumors evade immune surveillance by also a number of different mechanisms that also include the expression of FAST ligand, other pro-apoptotic molecules that inactivate and kill activated T cells. They induce a number of immunosuppressive molecules, TGF-beta, IL-10. They polarize antigen presentation. We didn't talk about the M2 macrophages or whatever, but there are macrophage phenotypes that are actually suppressive. But these tumors can also upregulate both T regulatory phenotypes as well as the development of myeloid-derived suppressor cells. Within the microenvironment of the tumor, it's also important to remember there is a phenomenon well described, the endothelial to mesenchymal transitioning. This MEMT phenomenon leads to development of mesenchymal type cells within the tumor stroma that are exactly like, or very similar to the hepatic stellate cell, in that they synthesize a number of different compounds as well as express on their surface many of the regulatory checkpoints that I talked about before that we saw with hepatic stellate cells, CTLA-4, PD-L1, as well as a number of other small molecules, nitric oxide, IDO, IL-10, etc. So this is where the two paradigms of transplant and cancer come together, although in a slightly different context. In one sense, transplant, this is where we want to go. In cancer, this is where they are and they want to get out of. But checkpoint inhibitors, checkpoint inhibitors now become a very fascinating approach to the management of cancer. So checkpoint inhibition basically means how can we reactivate T cells that have become inactive through this interaction with tumor cells, in this case, that express on their surface through the stroma or directly through the cancer cell other checkpoints, CTLA-4, PD-1, a number of other proteins. And there are now, as you know, biologic compounds that inhibit the CTLA-4 pathway, the PD-1 pathway, and the PD-L1. These are some of the drugs that are available, that are approved, and some of the FDA-approved indications. These are all basically what we call checkpoint inhibitors. And you'll remember seeing these pictures. This is a patient with a metastatic melanoma to the lung, treated with pembrolizumab. And you can see that after therapy, the metastatic melanoma deposits in the lung have decreased markedly. There have been some experiences, not very favorable, when liver transplant patients, or in fact, transplant patients in general, get a malignancy and then are treated with these checkpoint inhibitors. It's not too surprising to see that the experience is associated with a high incidence of rejection, and in some cases, these are fatal. So, probably not a very good option of using checkpoint inhibitors in a stable transplant patient, but if, the caveat that no patient should die without immunotherapy may still be true here. So I'll just conclude saying that the liver is a very interesting organ. This is something that I've been studying in the past 30 years of my research career. The stellate cell, like other mesenchymal-derived stromal cells, are immunomodulatory. We now believe that they have a critical role in the maintenance of peripheral tolerance. Hepatic stellate cells appear to modulate T cells through these checkpoint processes, through PD-L1, primarily mediated apoptosis. They also, as I suggested but didn't show you the data, influence the derivation of bone marrow-derived myeloid suppressor cells that are, in, at least in the mouse, CD11C-negative, CD11B-positive. And these myeloid-derived cells are very potent in inhibiting T-cell activation. They utilize a number of pathways that we know are immunomodulatory, arginase, inose, and also upregulate these checkpoint proteins. So there are very many similarities between the tolerance state in transplant and in cancer. So I'll just end by saying I'd like to recognize all of the people that I've worked with, particularly the four individuals in this picture, Angus Thompson, Jacob Mutis that remain at the University of Pittsburgh, Leanna Liu and Chi-Wan Chen that went with me to the Cleveland Clinic. And I think it's very telling that on the year that I was born, 1956, Ravdin wrote in this article regarding the complexity of liver disease, and I'll quote, "The time is coming when the practice of medicine will rest securely upon a firm scientific foundation, upon systematic understanding of the life processes in all their complexities, and no longer upon the insecure and shifting basis which partially support it today." I'd like to now just meant John Alverdi, who was the recipient last year, advised that maybe I should tell people a little bit about what I've done, what my interests are, and I think I appreciate that. Amy already mentioned this, so I won't talk about it. I did want to show my picture of the ACS induction in 1996, though. My research productivity over the past 30 years, as she mentioned, I would just say that during this period of time, when from the early 1990s, many of the publications were related to the new development of FK506 or tacrolimus. In fact, more than almost half of my publications were related to clinical transplantation, others in immunosuppressive drug development, and then my research interests, which relate to tolerance and animal models of alloimmunity. I'd like to thank these three individuals in particular that I consider my mentors. Willard Libby, who many of you in the room will know what he did, but don't not know who he is. Willard Libby received the Nobel Prize for his work in carbon-14 dating. And I worked in his lab for 2 years in high school. He taught me the rigors of scientific inquiry while I worked with him. And then my two professional mentors, Seymour Schwartz, who was the chair of surgery at the University of Rochester when I graduated, and then obviously Tom Starzl, who had a huge influence on my career. And then personal acknowledgments, my mother and father, who, interestingly, these pictures were taken from them, of them at Evansville College, where I lived and my two brothers were born, thus completing the circle of the Ravden connection. And then my family, Beth, who's here, my wife, and my four children here. And then I would just mention, I picked the topic, title, Good, Bad, and Ugly, because if you've ever seen this movie, you will remember that there are very interesting cinematographic presentations of different evolution of events that occur. And the director had a rule that what you saw was all you could see. In other words, what the camera captured. Things would go around and just pop up at the last minute, and you wouldn't know exactly how it happened. And I think the topic that I talked about today was exactly that. Checkpoint immune modulation and now therapy for cancer would have been hard to predict 10 years ago, that we are now at a convergence points in understanding of cancer immunobiology and transplant immunobiology. I would like to finally thank the IS Ravden Surgical Society for the honor of being here and the American College of Surgeons for allowing me to talk about my interests. Thank you.
We have a few minutes if somebody wants to ask a question.
Hello, Dr. Fung. I do have a question. You mentioned in one of your mouse studies that in the IL-2 knockout mice, there was rapid rejection of the livers because it required early T cell activation to activate these stellate cells. And I was wondering if there's any thought with that in mind for calcineurin inhibitors that inhibit the IL-2 pathway, if actually that's preventing tolerance.
Yeah. So Steven Strom, when he was alive about 20 years ago, showed very clearly that the use of these calcineurin inhibitors that are potent IL-2 suppressors actually inhibit tolerance induction. There are also many other experimental models, the use of IL-25, anti-IL-25 receptor antibody, or anti-CD25 IL-2 receptor antibody also inhibits tolerance, presumably through the mechanism of inhibiting T regulatory phenotype. So there are many things that I think we practice in surgery and transplant that go against probably the long-term picture. So if you look at many of those six patients that I talked about with the kidney transplants that Dr. Starza mentioned that were free to administration, all had rejection in their early post-op period. Yes?
James Harmon from Minnesota. I've read about the use of mixed lymphocyte reaction to study the effect of hepatic Kupffer cells, and they downregulated the responses. And I think maybe years ago, perhaps the Kupffer cells were misidentified. Maybe they were hepatic stellate cells, or would those experiments be repeated with the actual Kupffer cells and the stellate cells to show that which ones had the effect?
Yeah. So everything in the liver is connected. The stellate cells actually have an impact on Kupffer cell function through a mechanism similar to what we call the tumor macrophages. These M2 macrophages, in the presence of TGF-beta and other cytokines, actually take up also express PD-L1 and can inhibit lymphocyte activity. So they're interrelated. I think probably the more potent of the cells are the hepatic cell cells. You really don't need many hepatic cell cells to get this type of T regulatory suppression of T cell activation and T regulatory phenotype. Yeah. You're welcome. Yes.
Hi, Dr. Fung. Thank you. I was wondering, in all of your animal models if what the incidences of the de novo malignancies were, and if that was affected in specifically the interferon gamma and the PD-L1 mouse models.
Well, we know that there are animals that are deficient in the in these inhibitory molecules develop a proliferative a lymphoproliferative disorder. Most of these animals don't live long enough to develop de novo cancers unless you give them something like, you know, a carcinogen. So the incidence of cancers in this population outside of the lymphoproliferative disorders that you can get in mouse models really not all that impressive. Not that we looked at it. Okay, well, thank you very much.